Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The latest atrocity committed by a so-called refugee, Abdul Shukr Ezidi, has drawn fresh attention to the failings of the asylum system. He had pretended to convert to Christianity in order to hoodwink a Home Office tribunal into granting him asylum, which they did, despite the fact that he already had two convictions as a sex offender. And this has stirred the public conscience about the way in which the politicians and civil servants are administering public policy for asylum claims. The first reaction has been to blame the churches for failing to exercise due care and diligence, perhaps for an excess of naivety and wishful thinking as they presided over presented conversions. In fact, in practice, the Catholic Church is assiduous in documenting baptisms and conversions to Catholicism and is rightly proud of its RCIA programme, the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults, and it refutes the allegations that its own clergy have facilitated bogus asylum applications. Converting to Catholicism is a process that involves serious obligations of mass attendance as a catechumen before conversion and as a faithful Catholic afterwards. But the issue is not so much which denomination is aiding and abetting the bogus process, but why both the concept and practice of asylum has degenerated into the unworkable state that it's in. Of all the competing religions and philosophies, asylum is the product essentially of Christianity, of the First and Second Covenants, a fruit of Judeo-Christian revelation about the nature of humanity, that human beings are not disposable artifacts or part of the faceless crowd of collectivism, but images of the living God, and so sacred. However, the West in general, and the UK in particular, has repudiated the Christian faith whilst still trying to live off the fruit of its moral vision, of which asylum is part. But that fruit is turning sour. It's being used not as a medicine for society, but instead functioning as a poison to destroy the very society that created its values in a welter of multiculturalism and relativism. Monsignor Michael Nasir Ali, whose Muslim father converted from Islam, has been prominent in the public criticism about the asylum system, particularly after a previous attempted atrocity. He remarked the failed Remembrance Day attack in Liverpool by the would-be suicide bomber Imad al-Suleiman, a Jordanian who became an Anglican in 2015, had raised questions about the role of churches and whether, out of a desire to do good, they were in fact naive in supporting the asylum claims of Christian converts. I asked him to join me in giving some further thought to the place we find ourselves in now, following the latest bogus claim of conversion and the attack that followed. And he joins me now. Father Michael, thank you for joining this conversation. It comes at a moment of some political excitement as the whole issue of asylum seeking has hit the national press and attention. And I rather hope that what we could do in our conversation is talk about the theological and political roots of the whole system and then look at the way in which it might be abused. You came to national prominence when you made comments about the Islamist who blew himself up in Liverpool, having used conversion as a means of staying in the country. It was cosmetic conversion. He didn't mean it. Would you like to go back to that situation and just remind us of what you said? And then we might use that as a platform for moving on to the issues that have happened today with the Clapham tragedy.
Yes, of course, national prominence is a double-edged thing. And one comes into that sort of prominence for all sorts of good and bad reasons. Yes, I was rather surprised that this had happened because he had been prepared for the Christian faith and indeed for baptism and confirmation in the Anglican Cathedral in Liverpool. So he must have got over a number of barriers. But of course, it is true that however careful the churches may be, they can always be deceived on this matter, whatever the goodwill, and that the churches now, given the situation, have to be very wary and wise about what they do in terms of receiving people, preparing them, baptizing them, monitoring how they continue to practice the Christian faith. One kind of test that I had suggested at the time was the timing of the request to convert. So if the request comes after an asylum application has been rejected, then the churches have a duty, I think, to be very cautious. These are things that people will learn with experience, no doubt. The other thing that I had said at the time was that the churches can't second guess what the government might be doing, because the government has more information, which the churches do not have necessarily. And also the government is required to take other elements into account, for instance, a previous criminal conviction or some involvement in extremism of one kind or another. So religious belief and a change in religious belief, or it, of course it could be a change to atheism, which is also forbidden in many countries from where asylum seekers come. That is only one factor in determining an asylum application by those who do so.
One might say that because, as you quite rightly say, it's only one factor and there are other ones, economic, political, philosophical. If the system is broken, it's not the fault of the churches in the circumstances when they are doing exactly what they should do, which is trying to bring people into a reparative relationship with Jesus. I was very struck by a letter in the press today, which was published by somebody who's part of one of the tribunals, and he said it was extremely difficult to tell whether conversion was authentic or not. I think it must partly depend on the competence of the people making the judgment. It seems to me that in the experience I've had, if you have a living relationship with Jesus, it's quite hard to hide. There's something, just if I can interpolate my own experience for a moment, I was a BBC presenter on a faith and ethics show and had this argument with the Home Office in 2008 over an Iraqi woman who claimed to be converted. And it was the way she talked about her experience of Jesus having given wings to her soul, that the level of forgiveness and new birth, the experience of the Holy Spirit. In other words, it had an experiential authenticity, which was impossible to miss. And you wonder if the people who are taking responsibility for adjudicating these claims are theologically or spiritually literate in the first place. In other words, it goes back to, as you're rightly saying, to the mechanisms the government has put in place to test people's claims.
Yes, of course. I mean, you could tell all that because you are spiritually sensitive. But we can't assume that people who are making these judgments are or have to be indeed. I think we've got to make a basic distinction. I think you're probably working towards that in any case. The churches have an obligation to welcome people, to offer them help, sustenance, refuge, if that's the right word, regardless of who they are. I mean, this is very deep in the biblical tradition. But that is not the same thing as government policy. So the churches have to recognize their own obligation, but they also then have to recognize that governments, for various reasons, as you say, economic, social, financial, have to make hard decisions, and churches need to respect those decisions, even if sometimes they may not agree with them.
I want to take up your invitation and go back to the biblical roots, because I think there are two strands of philosophy, so to speak, informing the way in which the concept of asylum works. I mean, one is the First Covenant, the Old Testament, and the mandatory welcoming of the stranger and the vulnerable and the refugee. The other is the situation that existed politically after the Second World War in terms of the way in which post-war settlements set out to look at the refugee issue. One of the things that strikes me is that the theological vision of ancient Israel was unique in that it was predicated upon an understanding that all human beings were made in the image of God and therefore had an intrinsic value. I'm not aware in my exposure to the literature of the Egyptians and the Assyrians and the Babylonians that this anthropological insight was shared either at all or in anything like the same degree. It's a unique aspect of the Judeo-Christian vision of humanity, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, nearly every ancient culture that I can think of is characterized not by equality, but by inequality in various ways, whether it's the caste system or slavery, or whether it is the divinization of certain kinds of people. There are different ways in which this happens. The Judeo-Christian tradition, and of course, as you say, deeply embedded in the Older Testament itself, is based on human beings, all human beings, every human being, being made in God's image. And this confers a kind of dignity on them. So the chapter in Leviticus, which exhorts the people of Israel to love their neighbor, that is often quoted, it was quoted at me by a BBC interviewer, And I said at the time, and I say it again, that that chapter doesn't just say to love your neighbor, which of course meant a fellow Israelite, but it says to love the stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. I mean, that's the reason that was given. And of course, when there were strangers in Egypt, they were not treated equally. We know that. They were enslaved and persecuted and killed. So loving the stranger as yourself, I mean, this is a very hard thing to say to people, but that is indeed what the Bible says. Now, having recognized this in ancient Israel and in the Older Testament, of course, what has made it universal is the Christian church. So even if you consider the way in which the church spread in the Middle Ages in Western Europe, that it was with the help of the churches that rulers like Charlemagne, for example, were able to create a society based on the recognition of equal dignity. And this is detailed by Larry Siedentop in his book, for example, but by others also, how the idea of a personal relationship with God that every human person is called to results in this kind of equality of treatment of the dignity of human beings. So again, I mean, this is very often the case that so many of the insights of the Torah and of the prophets have been given universal currency, as it were, by the church.
Can I ask about reciprocity? If we go back into the First Covenant, refugees were welcome, the stranger was welcome, in a sense, as a metaphysical aspect to this. We are all refugees in time and space, making a pilgrimage to heaven. And in that sense, what we're talking about politically partly derives from a spiritual and metaphysical apprehension that's universal to all of us. But if we go back into the history of ancient Israel, when the refugees were welcomed in, they were welcomed in on the condition that they didn't destroy or distort the covenant relationship between the people and their God. In other words, they were given a hospitality that didn't extend to undermining the integrity of the original vision of humanity. Judaism had to remain in place. There are other passages, of course, which are concerned about the way in which intermarriage with other cultures proposed a danger to the integrity of the covenantal vision of Israel. We may not want to make too much of that, but we might at least want to recognize that the hospitality to the stranger didn't extend to allowing the stranger to change the basic DNA of the nation and its relationship with God.
Yes, there is a fundamental tension about this in the Older Testament. So four of the women who are recorded as being ancestresses of Jesus are Gentile. And of course, you know, the book of Ruth, the book of Jonah, these are all books that have an inclusive view of the mission of God among the people of Israel. There, as you say, there are other books like Ezra and Nehemiah that have a somewhat different concern, but that may well have been because of the historical circumstances surrounding the resettlement after the exile and what had happened in the exile and so on.
So there's a balance between these two values then?
Of course. I mean, you can't undermine the basic values of a society which has welcomed you, because that is the basis of your welcome.
That's the key, or the transition point, that I want to explore. I think that's the coherent focus for our discussion, because let's take this then to after the Second World War. We still have a geopolitical situation in which Judeo-Christian values set the tone for the repudiation of fascism and communism. I mean, we have three enormous philosophies: communism, fascism, and the Judeo-Christian West. And the Judeo-Christian West has won, and quite rightly, then begins to assert its compassionate anthropology and understanding of human nature. And in any discussion like this, people will often talk about kinder transport and the completely wonderful way in which the West, and in the UK in particular, offered sanctuary. Not as much, not as soon as it should do. There's a rather darker shadow of anti-Semitism in the 1930s in this country, but nonetheless, the kinder transport acts as emblematically, I think, for the values we're talking about. Isn't one of the problems that we face now after all the international concordats on refugees that took place in the 50s and 60s, that the geopolitical situation has changed a great deal? And even in this country, the Judeo-Christian moral framework is under pressure from other different philosophies, which have different anthropologies and different ways of gauging the value or less of the human person. Is it that transition in the last 80 years that has led to some of the strain that we now face as we try and put into work an asylum system that was created in different cultural and historical circumstances?
Well, I think we do need to look at the Refugee Convention itself and also arrangements that are made, for instance, by United Nations bodies like the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. But just going back to an adequate understanding of anthropology, I think what has happened in the West is that whilst it has abandoned, or to a great extent, the belief systems of the Judeo-Christian tradition, it has continued to hold most of its values. Now, this is a very dangerous thing to do, of course, because values depend on beliefs, like the smile on the Cheshire Cat. You don't know quite how long these values will last, given the abandoning of the beliefs. But I think that is how it is. So the recognition, widespread recognition in the West of the innate dignity of the human person is certainly derived from the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that has become the basis for a society that rejects racism, for instance, or sexism and all of these things.
This notion of the difference in values and beliefs, I think, is absolutely critical. And once again, will unfold, I think, quite helpfully for us. Because it seems to me it's almost like the position of sitting on the branch of a tree and sawing the branch off the tree. The branch, the values, in this case, are entirely dependent on the belief, the tree. And if you separate them, the values go down. And one of the ways in which I understand a crisis in the asylum system at the moment is that you have a government operating on the value system of the Judeo-Christian vision, but without any of the beliefs, and therefore without any of the checks and balances or a commitment to the integrity of the process that would derive or be fueled by the beliefs. Instead, they become politicized. I mean, I find myself very exercised by the fact that the teacher in the Batley crisis has got no asylum, is given no asylum by our society, because the beliefs that would provide that are missing. The Mike Freer, the Jewish MP for Finchley, is not given any form of kind of asylum within our society because he's been driven out as a refugee. In other words, just at the moment where to sustain the values that we're practicing, in the absence of the beliefs, that becomes impossible. And so that's part of the crisis that we're facing. And it's not a conversation that you hear in the public space. You don't hear it on the BBC. You don't hear it in the news. This disparity between the missing beliefs required to sustain the value system with integrity just doesn't appear to be something that anyone's aware of. And shouldn't it really be us, the Christian Church, putting that element of disparity back into the public conversation and saying to our community, if you want to treasure human beings in this particular way and express it politically, you're going to need to adopt the belief system that gives them that particular status, and that's Christianity.
Yes, I mean, Mike Freer, all our sympathy with him in his situation, and the teacher from Batley also, but in a sense, they are fortunate because my friend, possibly yours as well, Sir David Amis, was actually murdered. And this is, of course, this is part of the reason for the fears that other MPs now have. Stephen Timms was stabbed in his own surgery, and there are many examples. I think what happened historically in Britain anyway, when it began to become more diverse, that instead of saying to people who were coming in, this is who we are, it is on the basis of who we are, formed for centuries by the Judeo-Christian tradition, that we are welcoming you, but this is who we are, that would have resulted in hospitality, in dialogue, in accommodation, all of those things. Instead of which, an attempt was made to use this new diversity to sideline the Judeo-Christian tradition and to invent things like multiculturalism, which basically said, we don't know who we are anymore. We certainly don't know who you are. And we're only just discovering that gradually. So let's get on with our lives more or less separately. So tolerance basically was not about engagement and interaction and integration. It was about leaving people to live separately. And that has caused the problem, some of the problems that we are facing. This is a very dangerous thing for the West to have done, particularly Britain in this case. And we are now discovering that sheer diversity doesn't make for a cohesive and peaceful and just society.
Perhaps you can help me with the clarity of my thought here, because the way my thought begins, and I'm never quite sure how to develop it, if we for the moment treat multiculturalism as a facet of the progressive left, as a form of the political utopianism that everyone is equal, all things should be equal, values should be flat, which is a secularized parody of the Christian notion of human value, then it seems to me that the progressive left have piggybacked on Christian values, using them to implement their own philosophical framework, but ultimately not intending to preserve them. They're simply a means to an end. And suddenly, the Christian presence in this country finds that it's been hoodwinked, that actually there was never an intention, ultimately, to see human beings as having a value given by God, but instead, either through capitalism, which tends to treat people at any rate as dispensable cogs in a mercantile wheel, or through, we'll call it cultural Marxism for the moment, or the left, which essentially sees people having value only as part of their collective identity. We might add Islam and say that as a variant of that, Islam also has a degree of collectivism in it, which is a requisite for belonging. But all these three philosophies have no investment in the beliefs that the hospitality of looking after the stranger and the refugee are based on. And therefore, ultimately, if the Christian ideology, the Christian presence, the Christian moral conscience gives way before these competing systems, then the very values it's trying to seek will disappear. And that, it seems to me, that's the moment of crisis or the crossroads that we've arrived at in Britain.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, this business about secularizing Judeo-Christian discourse and leaving the values whilst abandoning the belief systems that underpin these values is characteristic both of the progressive left, as you call it, but also of the mercantile right.
Yeah.
For very similar reasons, actually, where human beings are simply seen as dispensable elements in a collective vision, which, you know, the collective vision might be that of communism, or in mercantile capitalism, it might be that of some kind of industry which uses labor simply as units in production. And that, of course, is the reason for the widespread alienation that we find among people in our cultures. With Islam, certainly, I mean, Islam also has a collective vision, and the collective always takes precedence over the individual. I mean, I remember a very good and moderate Muslim friend of mine once saying to me, we never know when you're fasting. I said to him, well, you know, Jesus had said that you shouldn't know. But before I'd finish, he said, but in Islam, fasting is a social act. And anyone who's been in a Muslim country during Ramadan, that's approaching again, will know that. So whether you're young or old, a visitor, pregnant, ill, you can't undermine the social reality of the fast. And this is true of many other elements, of course, in those societies. Against that, I think the primacy of the person, the recognition of conscience, these are the sort of basic elements that have led to the kind of democracy we have. The idea that people are not just subjects to a ruler or to a system, but are citizens who contribute, who consent to how they're ruled and governed.
I mean, there are clearly, well, I mean, one issue is the extent to which the individual conscience can stand up to the collective. And we're back again to values and belief. If there isn't sufficient belief within the system, then the emphasis or the privilege of the collective conscience, it seems to me, must give way against the weight of the collective. And I think that's partly how I understand the clash of cultures between Islam and the secular West. the secular West also believes in conscience, although it uses a slightly different kind of language. It's more about existential authenticity than it is moral accountability. But nonetheless, they're cousins. And as you quite rightly say, the individualism of the Christian tradition disappears behind the weight of a collectivist one. But it seems to me there are two crises at the moment, and perhaps we can address them, or at least describe them briefly. One is the crisis of accountability after conversion. And I want to take a moment, since we're both Roman Catholics, to talk about the difference between the Protestant and the Catholic understanding of that. And the other is to look at how we might articulate the real crisis, the deeper crisis of this gap between values and beliefs for society, because it quite clearly it's picking us up on the first crisis, that the churches are not being assiduous enough in their care of conversion. But there's almost complete silence on the second one. If we go to the first one, in an earlier conversation, you quite rightly reminded me that whatever else happened, if a Muslim became a Christian, they'd have to be baptized and there would be a record of the baptism. And in that sense, there should be records within all the Christian churches of anyone who's converted from Islam. But one of the things I found myself saying in the public space is that within the Protestant tradition, there's very little emphasis beyond the immediate sense of responsibility that a congregation might quite properly have towards someone who's joined it within Protestantism, because ultimately, whether you go to church or don't go to church, whether you go to receive the sacraments or you don't, is again, it's a matter of your preference, your conscience, your taste, your churchmanship, your spirituality, and so on. There isn't a collective view on that. But if you become a Roman Catholic, not only do you have to be baptized, but you're catechized into a way of life in which the continuation of that journey is not mandated, is the wrong word, but it's covenantally assumed by both parties, not to go to Mass is to fall into sin. Do you want to just talk a little bit about the way in which the Anglican or the Protestant aftercare from conversion might be different from the way in which the Catholic Church sees its responsibilities?
Yes, I think it is different, but we also need to note that the person from the Baptist Church, which has been responsible for the baptism of some of these asylum seekers on the barge, has outlined what the Baptist Church in Weymouth have actually done to teach and disciple and baptize and continuing care for these people. And it makes a lot of sense. But as you say, this is not required and it could be ignored. So I went to a meeting in Rome where I met Rick Warren and other people who were also there for this meeting. And when I came back, a lady said to me here in Surrey, she said, "Oh, I'm seeing my pastor, I understand." So I said, "Well, who is your pastor?" And she said, "Rick Warren." And here she is living in Surrey, and she thinks that this man living several thousand miles away is her pastor, because she's quite happy with that. Well, this could not happen in the Catholic Church, of course. But I think we need to remind the priests, parish priests in the Catholic Church also, of the duty to take seriously the process of conversion, whether they're using RCIA, what the process has been, how has a person come to baptism, who the sponsors are, and how people, not just the priest, but people in the congregation, particularly those who've been sponsors, are going to care for this person and their continued growing in the faith. The obligation, as you say, to attend Mass on Sundays and days of obligation, all of these would reveal, as well as that kind of spiritual insight that you were talking about earlier, whether this conversion is genuine or not. The churches have to do something to tighten up their act in this area. There's no question about that. But having said that, it is not the task of the church to determine who is and who is not a genuine asylum seeker. That is the task of the government. The church is not equipped to make this judgment. And it shouldn't be used as a surrogate by the government for it either.
Well, that's a very helpful and important thing to say. And thank you, too, for balancing my Catholic zeal with fair treatment for good Protestant practice. That's quite absolutely the right thing to do. we recognize then that the churches have to take more responsibility for the process of conversion and for catechesis and for growing people in a stable faith afterwards. And that's partly relational. As you quite rightly say, if your pastor lives 4,000 miles away, there's a level of accountability and relational integrity that is hard to bridge. But putting that to one side, can we go perhaps to the bigger crisis? And I think the one that's much more difficult to do anything about, because tightening up pastoral practice is just common sense. But this crisis between the Christian civilization and a political process and a secularized political process, whereby the political establishment is still employing categories of anthropological understanding that derive from Judeo-Christianity, but applying them in a way that has little relationship to the beliefs that underlie it. We don't hear Christian spokespeople standing up and saying to the government, you really are soaring off the branch you're sitting on. You can't afford just to be careless with the belief system that's led to the privileged culture you're operating in. If you lose it, you'll lose the values as well. Either this is too complex philosophically or ideologically to be said, or it requires too much courage. But for one reason or another, it's not happening. Might it happen? And if it did happen, how would it take place, do you think?
Well, I mean, I've said this on a number of occasions, and the response has been the constructivist one, that there is actually no, in the end, this widespread constructivism in the West, which it has, I think, derived from neo-Marxism, is that there's no given reality, there's no objectivity about anything. We just make our own values. And so if we think that human beings are all equal and should be treated equally, this is something we've made for ourselves in the end, just as we've made for ourselves what is authentic relationship between men and women, for example, and just as we've made for ourselves ideas about nationhood or ideas about conflict and peacemaking and things. They're not rooted in any kind of objective vision of reality. And I think particularly the Catholic Church has a long history of insisting that the world has been made in a particular way, that we have been made in a particular way, and that if we don't respect that objectivity, then we are led astray in one way or another. Particularly the Catholic Church, because I think the Protestant churches on the whole have abandoned this, any kind of attempt at relating revelation to reason and a particular theological anthropology to natural law.
I remember my conversion took place halfway through my undergraduate period as a law student, and I remember fighting very hard in my jurisprudence exams for the concept of natural law and doing it largely unsuccessfully, partly again, I think, because of this divergence between values and beliefs, and the values when they were different. Again, as I've grown up in the faith, I've become more and more aware that natural law is something that the Catholic Church has a very deep rooted experience and witness about, and is capable of articulating with some authority and some conviction in a way that the Enlightenment churches have given up on, but perhaps partly because they don't have the same philosophical rootedness. But whatever the reason is, this again pushes me towards the conclusion that if Judeo-Christian culture is going to be saved in our society, it may need to be Roman Catholic voices that speak up to at least articulate what the diagnosis is. And of course, in terms of evangelization, offer a solution's quite the wrong word, really, but offer a way of managing what otherwise looks like being the collapse of our civilization and its values.
Yes, I mean, natural law is not everything. It is one element in what the church has to be saying. I am Augustinian enough also to recognize that the way in which God made the world and the way in which he has made us is nowadays, these days, is not how God intended it to turn out. Something has gone deeply wrong. I often think of William Golding saying that there is a darkness in human beings, but underneath that darkness, there is a light. It's not just natural law, but also redemption that we have to preach, that there is such a thing as being redeemed or being restored being reconciled. And then there is the resurrection of Jesus Christ points us to the transformation of creation. So is and ought. I mean, so there is a distinction between is and ought. And not everything that is, we can appeal to it in terms of, you know, justifying our behavior or our thought. There is also the ought, that the resurrection of Christ makes it possible for us to talk about of how things ought to be. And I mean, all of those things have to be held together in the church's proclamation, if you like, from time to time, depending on what is the issue.
I don't want to move from the sublime to the prosaic, but you've been an Anglican diocesan bishop and responsible for overseeing programs of evangelization. To their great credit, Anglicanism has the Alpha Course, and it's been used very effectively to convey both the Augustinian and the insights from Aquinas of both natural law and the need for conversion. What do you say to your colleagues in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church about the need for a refreshed response to our society? I get the impression still that the Catholic Church hasn't quite recovered from its period in cultural and ideological exile in this country, and it sees itself primarily as being pastorally responsible for those who are cultural Catholics, but as yet to respond adequately to this, to the vacuum of belief that secularization has imposed on us. And at the moment, multivariable Anglicanism isn't grasping particularly well. And this is not an intention to put down the Anglicans. All hands are on deck, are required in any way whatsoever. And congratulations to the Baptists in Weymouth. But is there a way of articulating a fresh requirement, a vision for evangelization that the Catholic Church can perhaps use to respond to the larger dynamics that this asylum crisis has revealed?
Yes, I mean, what you say about the recovery of a mission in England and to England, let's keep it to England, by the Catholic Church is hugely important. What I would like to suggest, I mean, this may be provocative, but what is the meaning for Catholics of the Ecclesia Anglicana that existed from the end of the 6th century to 1534? What is the meaning of it? It is an incredibly rich heritage. And of course, we are not claiming any kind of monopoly of it. Other churches are also welcome to share this heritage. And indeed, many of the material artifacts of this heritage are in the hands of the Church of England, not of the Catholic Church. But there is an intellectual, a mystical, a liturgical, a theological, philosophical heritage, which is of huge importance to English culture and civilization. I don't think we can put it any more modestly than that. But the Catholic Church has to understand that its mission in this country has to be related to that inheritance. Now, that's the first thing. The second is that throughout even the period of separation until very recently, there were very important elements in Anglicanism that were oriented to Catholic truth and unity. They need to be recognized. I mean, even in our own lifetime, there have been theologians like Eric Maskell, Henry Chadwick, Pope John Paul II, I believe, called Henry Chadwick a separated doctor of the church.
Excellent.
I mean, this is the kind of inheritance that we should be claiming and building upon. Of course, this has to be related to the Catholic Church in other countries. But the question, how is there going to be a Catholic Ecclesia Anglicana in England, is, I think, a key question.
I think that's a wonderful summary and an excellent question to finish on. Father Michael, thank you so much for joining us in this conversation and for helping us untangle the complexity of the situation that we find in. We're very grateful. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.